There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
A warm yet platonic greeting to you, the Nerdist Podcast listener. I think I have a little something going on. It's like not quite a cold, but not quite a horrible lung infection, but something's happening that's pulling my voice down here into the bassier tones. So that's nice. That's nice. This is what like old radio guys sound like.
Yeah, coming up next, we got another rock block of Aerosmith, followed by the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
Hey, if you live in Los Angeles and are going to be in the area on January 23rd, that's Monday at 7:30 p.m., I'm going to do a long overdue snippet of reading from my book, The Nerdist Way, which came out 2 months ago. But I wasn't around Los Angeles at the time when it came out, so I couldn't do this then, so I'm doing it now. So come on by. It's a free Q&A session. There's going to be a book signing right afterwards. And there's going to be food and people and nerds and fun. So come on by Monday, January 23rd, 7 p.m., reading and Q&A of The Nerdist Way with me, Chris Hardwick.
And
guys, it's happening. I'm taping a stand-up comedy special. I shit a little bit more about it each day until we actually tape it on February 17th. But if you're going to be in New York around then, soon I will have information to get you free tickets. Because I would really like you to be there. Not people who don't have any idea who I am. Why would I want that? I want you guys to make me feel better about myself. Because I have a comics ego. But I will be doing a bunch of sets in preparation for that stand-up comedy special on February 17th. For instance, if you live in Toronto the 9th through 11th of February, I'm coming to the Comedy Bar. I'm going to do a shitload of sets there to get ready for the special the week after. I'm also performing all over Los Angeles if you're here in the next few weeks. I'm literally going up everywhere. Everywhere. I'm just going to go to fucking Starbucks and order a drink loudly and try to spin it and do a bit to the annoyance of the other customers, because that is how committed I am to doing sets. So, yeah, if you're around then, check that out. Details for our other live shows, as we are doing podcasts around the country as well, are at nerdist.com/calendar. I'd really like to send digital hugs to the Hover people, because this episode of Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover. Hey, I get it. You have a crazy idea for a website that may not be so crazy someday, so you have to register that business. You need to go to Hover to register your domains, because that is all they do. They register domains. It is simple Unix philosophy. They do one thing, they do it simply, they do it well. They don't try to sell you a bunch of other services. They get right to it. You can actually talk to a live human being if you need customer support. They make it that easy. Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, there's a no-hold policy. You get a live person. You can set up emails, forward emails, redirect domains, create URL extensions, set privacy controls, and it's all within just a few clicks. So, if you need to register a domain, make sure you go to hover.com/nerdist and use the offer code Nerdist to get 10% off your domain name registration. Thank you so much to Hover for being a continuous sponsor of the Nerdist Podcast. We love you for that. And now this episode, Scotty in. I can't actually do. I really wanted to get in there and do the Scotty in, but now I've completely shredded my voice, which was already on the edge anyway. Oh, I'm gonna cough. All right, I'm not gonna cough. Okay, I'm not coughing. Oh, think of a grapefruit. Does that help? No, that sneezes. Oh crap! I'm so sorry. I could have just cut this out, but I won't.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Feeling good?
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm good. Good.
Scott Ian.
How are you?
Jonah and Matt are not here. Matt is coming back from CES, I think, or he's going to CES. I don't think you don't know if you're coming or going to CES. I think you just go, and then it's a weird time vortex, and then you're back home, and you wake up in your underwear in your bed, and you don't know how you got there.
Can't you just find out about new gear coming out just by going on the internet and seeing it on the internet instead of actually having to go to a convention for it?
Weirdly, we do have the technology now to just look at things remotely.
Right. If only there was a gadget where I could look at other gadgets.
Well, I better go to CES and see if they have that.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. It's so crazy. I mean, listen, I don't mind. I did CES for quite a few years, and it's exciting and fun. There's a lot of crap that you have to wade through.
Right.
The car section is the funniest part because it's not for cars. It's just that they're showcasing like a mobile audio and video.
Okay, sure.
And so they get these cars and they trick them out with monitors in places you would never have, and like
right.
in the they're like a flat and just like some weird LCD flat screen under the trunk in the hood there, and then on the sides
in case.
And it's basically they're these giant subwoofers that have an engine. That's essentially what they are.
Right. Do they have those hot ladies in thongs?
Hot in quotation marks. Yeah,
well,
it's like
I mean,
it's Vegas,
yeah.
So it's a you know like you can see who you know. It's there. A lot of them are strippers,
right?
And I'm not saying that as like I'm just a disgusting male assuming that girl's a stripper. Like I know for a fact a lot of them are exotic dancers.
Exactly.
And so
exotic dancers. I like the ones where it's like lowrider magazine style, like those types of displays.
Just you know like like a fucking a spike heel that the base point is the size of a molecule,
yeah.
And then it's you know it's 15 inches tall.
About 45 pounds too heavy to be wearing that bathing suit.
I mean, listen, it's CES absorbs a lot of the resources of Las Vegas. Although it's not going on at the same time as the Adult Entertainment Expo this year, which usually they're this kind of the same weekend.
Oh no, that's a clusterfuck.
Have you been to one of those?
No, I've never been to never been to either.
Don't go.
I try and stay away. Even Comic-Con, I used to go to Comic-Con pretty much regularly, and I've stayed away from that now for a few years. It's just conventions are kind of a bummer.
You're in a different position, though, because, I mean, I guess you could just put a mask on, or you could just say you're not Scott Ian, but you're cosplaying as Scott Ian.
Yeah.
No, I'm a big Anthrax fan. I don't know.
Well, that is my biggest issue, is just not even being able to walk around the floor there, because I asked to get... I always get asked to come down and do signings there, and it's fun, but you can't do anything. I can't walk 4 feet without getting stopped.
You want to see everything.
I want to see everything, and I can't. And I actually thought about I should just put my Gene Simmons mask on and walk around, and nobody would bother me.
Are you like a mask, or would you actually do the full makeup?
No, like the mask. I have one of those crappy rubber, like full head Gene Simmons mask I could just put on, and then I'd be really sweaty after 5 minutes. But
this is going back a stretch. But when I was a little kid and Kiss was just fucking the hot shit, every kid, like at every carnival, got the Kiss face paint.
Oh,
which
I've had it,
which was the worst thing you can do to your parents, because that shit just gets you sweat it off and it just gets fucking everywhere, just like black, white, and red.
Yeah, it's gross
everywhere.
It's gross. I've done it a few times as a kid, and then most recently, actually, I guess it was back in 01 or 02 when I was hosting the rock show on VH1, and it was the Halloween episode. So they put me in full Gene makeup, full costume, and I was interviewing Ozzy that day, and he had been told that it's Scott, and I know Ozzy. I've known him, you know, at that point for 15 years or something, and he was told it's Scott from Anthrax. He's the guy who hosts the show. He's interviewing you. He had been out doing promo since, started with Howard Stern that morning for like doing promo for his record, and it's like 5 p.m. now, so he's been going all day.
And he's Ozzy.
And he's Ozzy, right? And this is like,
the Ozzy factor.
This is when Ozzy was like, it was really like full on like Osbournes, and he was just kind of not really there. And,
right.
And so Sharon and Ozzy walk into the studio, and I say hi to Sharon, and I see him looking at me from across the room with like, just this shit smell face, like, what have I gotten myself into? Who is this jackass dressed as Gene Simmons? What am I doing here? How low have I sunk that I'm promoting my record with some dude dressed up like Gene Simmons? Like, So we sit down and we start talking, and I'm asking him questions, and he's giving me nothing.
Oh,
like literally, like, so, you know, I heard the record and blah, and he's like, uh-huh, you know, just. And I'm like,
he thinks he thinks you're punking him.
He's like, Ozzy hates me. I'm like, in my brain, I'm like, oh my God, he hates me. Like, what happened here? What's going on? What's going on? And it's just going terrible, like 5 minutes of like nothing. And I'm just trying to come up with things to say now and literally sweating through the makeup. And all of a sudden, like, he kind of leans in and he starts staring at me really close. I'm like, oh boy, this is about to get really weird. And he's like, it's you. It's you. I can't do the accent. And I'm like, yeah, it's Scott. He's like, oh my God, mate. Oh my God. Like, and I'm like, I thought they told you. And he's like, no. And meanwhile, I know they told him, but sure. He's like, no. And then Shara's like, of course they told you, Ozzy. He's like, oh, and then he gives me a big hug, and then the next 15 minutes was awesome, and I was like, oh, I said, I thought you hated me. He goes, well, I thought it was just some asshole dressed up like, who's this asshole dressed as Gene Simmons with a bald head?
Didn't the chin beard give it away?
It was Ozzy. It was, you know, very just like, no idea. Yeah, it was.
That is the Scott Ian signature chin beard. I think it should be the Ian from now on.
It should be the Ian. But yeah, that's the last time I dressed up as Gene. He kind of scared me off it a little bit.
I love the I had Ozzy on the podcast last year, and I was terrified that it was going to be that situation because he doesn't know who I am,
right?
And I was afraid I would ask him a question and be like, right,
yeah, uh huh.
But he was so thoughtful and wonderful and had great stories and
cool.
He was such a sweet guy.
Yeah, he's awesome. That's why I was so like taken aback. I'm like, oh my God, this guy either doesn't know or I did something to piss him off.
Well, you're lucky that. That's one of those situations where it could have completely damaged your friendship with him for years, and neither one of you would have known.
I know. What if he never said anything, and it like just would have ended terrible, and they would have edited it somehow together where it would have worked for like 60 seconds, and then, yeah, I don't see the guy for 10 years thinking Ozzy hates my
guts. Someone interviews you, and they're like, so what do you think about Ozzy? And you're like, I don't know. We used to be friends, and then this one time.
Yeah, and he's like, what? That was you? Why didn't you say something 10 years ago?
Well, I'm glad it all worked out. I'm glad you and Ozzy got together. I feel like I've known you for about 10 years, maybe? Because you
late 90s.
You and Pearl probably. Used to go to the, when the, because you're a huge comedy fan.
Right.
So you guys used to go to that, you know, that, what was the?
Old Largo.
The monolith Monday night comedy Largo show that, you know, that a lot of people spun out of.
Yes.
Like the Pattons and the Sarah Silvermans and the David Crosses and the
I knew them all when.
I mean, that was when everyone's career. It's funny how long it takes, like, because within the scene, all those guys started kind of in the early 90s when they migrated to Los Angeles.
Right.
And then in the late 90s, Largo was like, that was the room to go to.
It was the epicenter.
And it still took another, I don't know, 5 to 10 years for all of those people to really hit. But from that standpoint, man, those Monday night shows.
Oh, it was the greatest. And I've never really thought of it that way, but like when you think about those Monday nights, I mean, it was so hard to get in that room. And certainly there were people outside of just comedy nerds like me who
it's a small
were
room.
Coming there, a tiny room. But, you know, you certainly had bookers from TV shows coming because people were starting to get booked on, you know, on late night talk shows and stuff out of that scene, already were being booked, you know. But it took, I guess, the real mainstream, you know, movies, let's say, it took the real mainstream much longer to catch on. Like, you needed to already have broken out of Largo in some way, shape, or form before that took notice. But that was the launching pad for everybody, you know, for so many comedians. Zach, I mean, look at Zach.
Yeah.
You know, crazy. I mean, I remember Jack Black, you know, with Tenacious D. I swear I remember seeing him play at Largo and other places around town to nobody. I mean, literally nobody. Less people than were actually in those fake intros from the HBO show.
Yes.
Like, you know, and so it's kind of cool to see people that, you know, you became friends with and thought were really funny and talented and then all go on the.
It's always just
careers.
Nice because in your head when people kind of make it, then you go, I knew it.
Yeah.
It was like you knew, you know, you got to sort of be early adoptery about comedy.
Yeah, and then I could be the old grandpa guy sitting on his, you know, porch going, "Oh, he hasn't been funny since 1997."
That's
you know?
When he was amazing.
Yeah. Now hook the hangover schmangover.
Those were cuz there was no real
you know, like going on the road, I hadn't been going on the road at that time, but it was still like comedy was in a lull in the late 90s because the 80s sort of destroyed club comedy for, you know, everyone just got oversaturated. Right. And so there were not a lot of rooms where people who did the kind of comedy that we did, that like that specific group, where you could go into a full room of people and destroy. Most of the time, if you were just out in the world, it, you know, like you, it was a little bit of a struggle.
Yeah, I mean, that was an oasis. I had never seen anything like it before. I got introduced to it through through Posehn because I was a crazy Mr. Show fan. And then Brian and I became friends, and then that's when I started going to shows there. I think he must have said, you know, if you ever go to Largo on a Monday night, like you'll probably see Bob and David there. And that's when I literally at the time lived around the corner from Largo right over there. Off of Fairfax, so it was so perfect.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was the best. I miss it. I've only been to the new spot a few times now, and it's also because I live like 40 miles from there now, so it's kind of harder to
go. And you got a baby,
yeah,
and you're married, and it's like it's harder to whimsically just go, oh, fuck it, let's just go see comedy tonight.
Yeah, it is, and now it literally takes like it's got to be like Patton Oswalt sending me a car to come. And it's still like, I don't know if I can make it, bro.
The new Largo is great. I love it. I love the Coronet Theater. The little room at Largo is great, too. But I will always have a very special place, you know.
And they didn't give a shit in there, which is what I love, too. Like, they didn't cater to, you know, celebrities coming in, like it did the whole like, don't you know who I am?
It was almost
thing.
Too much in the opposite direction where they, you know, like
you couldn't just get a table. Like if you didn't have a reservation, you weren't getting a table.
Nope.
Simple as that. And it's
kind of great.
They allowed, you know, like what was it? Maybe a dozen people could stand by that tiny little bar in the back. And that was it. Like that was it. And there was no fucking around. And like if you talked, you were shit on by whoever's on stage and generally thrown out. Like what was that dude's name? Flanagan. Like,
yeah, Flanagan.
I mean,
still runs Largo.
Yeah, they didn't fuck around.
He did not fuck around.
I loved it. I love that.
He runs a tight ship, and it's good, and it's great. And those shows were fun. And that Largo is where I saw in the late 90s. It's where I saw our early 2000s. Mitch Hedberg did a bit where he said he wrote a spec menu. And so he just went through and read all these menu items. He'd be like, I am not sure I am using braised correctly in that context.
Yeah, that was another thing. The food.
Never saw him do that anywhere else.
You had to eat when you sat down.
Food, yeah.
We offered one time, we didn't want to eat. Like we had eaten already. There was a bunch of us, and we just said, we'll just give you the money for the minimum. And they said, no, you have to order food. It was like,
you to eat.
You're saving money. We'll just give you the money.
Right.
Don't make us food. And you have to eat. So we just ordered food and it sat there.
I remember the food being pretty good. But I definitely want you on Talking Dead this next round. You were in the pilot for Talking Dead.
Yes.
And so you helped get that show picked up. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was a blast. And you are an insane zombie fanatic. But
hey, I got to get made up by Greg and his team and get to be a zombie for a day on the set of that webisode. So for me, that was like more payment than I ever deserved to go sit there and talk about zombies with you. Like, that's not like they flew me to New York to sit around with you and talk about zombies and like paid for drinks. It was like, it was already win-win. And then I got to be a zombie as well. So,
you know, what's funny is to see, like guys like yourself and bands like Anthrax or Rob Zombie or people where you go, when you sort of peel back the layers, you kind of like, because I think people assume those guys are fucking crazy.
Exactly.
What's it like hanging out with Rob Zombie? You guys drink goat blood? I'm like, no, he's a normal nerdy guy who just happens to do this thing. And at the core of it, that's really who you guys are.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, most of us, I know some dudes who aren't as, let's say, easy to get along with, let's say, and, you know, aren't into as many nerdy things. I guess maybe you just have to find what they're into. Like, a lot of people think Kerry King from Slayer is, you know, like, he would be the epitome of, like, oh, God, don't talk to him. Like, he's evil. But, you know, if you talk to Kerry about the right subjects, he's the nicest guy in the world. Like, he doesn't care about comic books, but if you get into a discussion of snakes or, you know, Jägermeister, then, you know, or The Simpsons, you know, you're in. I shouldn't be blowing Kerry's cover.
You know? Oh, yeah. No, sorry. Yeah, he wants to talk about darkness and evil. What? When was your first Comic-Con? When did you go to your first Comic-Con?
Wow. Probably 90s. I guess sometime mid-90s. I moved to L.A. in 90. So my first one was probably somewhere, I would assume, around 95. Somewhere yeah. around there, 95, 96.
Was it San Diego? Was the San Diego show you went to?
It must have been.
Yeah.
Right? I guess. Was it somewhere before there?
Well, I mean, there's just Comic-Cons everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, my first San Diego was then. Oh, my first actual comic convention?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I was a kid. Probably, you know, just some weird, lame convention in New York when I was a kid, you know, 11 or 12 years old, something like that.
Who was appearing? Would you remember any of the highlights of the show?
I don't even think they had appearances back then. This was literally like a bunch of tables set up.
With comics.
With boxes and comics. And you know, you just go around and sift through people's boxes and look for shit.
It was
needed.
A step above a garage sale, basically.
It was. It was like probably at a Jewish center. It was like at a Jewish center in Queens, in like the room where people get bar mitzvahed or married, and they just it was a bunch of weird dudes with tables set up and boxes on them filled with comics.
Under their breath going, someday we're going to take over. And everyone being like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. And as kids,
and here we are.
Me and my friends, of course, we would immediately go, besides, you know, looking to fill holes in our collection, we would immediately go looking for Playboys and penthouses. Like,
oh,
because
yeah.
They would just be out on tables and nobody would look at you weird if you were standing around looking at them.
No.
Which was like weird in those days.
I'm just a vagina nerd. I don't know.
Yeah.
I really nerd out on vaginas.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was like 1975. You know, it was that kind of stuff. There was no internet yet for
no,
porn.
And the 70s is when they really, because, you know, like all of the nudie mag stuff before then was just, was very artfully done and you'd see boobs, but then, and then not much. And the 70s. Just like all bets were off, or like full frontal bush. A lot of ladies had what is now the modern day Ian.
That's gross.
Sorry.
I don't know what I, and it's gross in so many ways. I can't even think of just the idea of this, of it looking like that, would pretty much turn someone off of ladies forever.
A little
I think.
Bit of a chin beard.
I mean, imagine it was just like hanging down that long.
How long does it take to grow a chin beard? How long does that take? Is that just nonstop for decades?
Well, I've had something here since 86, but
Jesus.
That's not how long it obviously.
Sure.
I think if I just shaved my beard tomorrow, this would probably take about 2 years.
Wow.
I'm thinking. I'm a very swarthy Jew, so it could actually maybe be more like 2 months for
could
all
be two
I
months.
Know. Like this here right now, that's only a few days. That's
oh,
maybe like
Jesus.
This is like 3 days.
You might be a lycanthrope. So, you
yeah.
might be one of those wolf boys.
I have pictures from 87 where I once just let we were making, I think it was when we were making Among the Living. So it was like this 3 month period where I just didn't shave. I didn't have any goatee thing going on. I just didn't shave. And I had long hair then, and literally my beard, I mean, 3 months, I had this crazy Grizzly Adams beard that pretty much grew up to my eyes, into my eyebrows.
Your eyelids.
Which at the time were still, as before I actually did any kind of manscaping, so I kind of had a unibrow back then in the 80s anyway, so I really was JoJo the Wolf Boy.
Yes.
I literally turned into that. Either that or Wolfman Jesus. It was one of the...
Oh, Wolfman Jesus. That's how he came back 3 days later. He got bitten by a wolf.
And I have pictures of that. I mean, I was just a hair face. It was crazy.
Well, we've had several conversations about you, because you've been a comedy fan for so long. You had some great stories about like the Comedy Store from the 80s, and you had some Sam Kinison story that was awesome. And how
yeah.
were you influenced by comedy in the 70s and the 80s?
Yeah, you know, I've been into it. And I can't even really think how, because like the specific things I could think like, well, you know, my parents were into this. So like my mom was really into horror. Like since I was a little kid, I got into horror because my mom loved horror movies. And like she turned me on to horror and reading Stephen King and all that kind of stuff. So but comedy, I can't specifically remember like how. It's definitely something I must have gotten into somehow on my own. But like I remember buying the Steve Martin record, Let's Get Small.
Yes.
Like, I remember buying that album. You know, like I was a huge fan of his in the 70s. And I mean, all kinds of stuff from Red Fox to, you know, of course, I can't remember anything right now. But anything that was funny in the 70s, I was watching Saturday Night Live when it started.
Me
I was
too.
A huge Carlin fan. Like, I've been into comedy since I was a little kid. So always, like, I remember going to the, what's that place? It's total brain fart. The place that Louis walks into at the beginning of his TV show.
Comedy Cellar.
The Comedy Cellar. I mean, I used to go to that place all the time, late 70s, early 80s. Like, as far as I could remember, as soon as I could get into places, I would go and watch live comedy.
And what was the Kinison story that you told me?
The Kinison story was we were massive fans. Like, when I say we, Anthrax, we were all massive fans of Sam's. And we sampled him in our song, I'm the Man. We sampled his scream in that song. And we needed, like, it was already at the time where you had to start getting permission. You couldn't just sample stuff randomly anymore because people were starting to sue.
Yeah.
So we got permission, you know, from his management to use his scream in the song. And we had found out, like, through his management to our manager that, oh, yeah, Sam's a big fan. He said, tell the guys he's stoked and, you know, they could use whatever they want and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we couldn't believe it that Sam, you know, had even heard of us. So cut to some point in 88, I think we were actually opening for Ozzy out here. I think it was like December 88 maybe. And we were staying at the Hyatt right next door to the Comedy Store. And our drummer, Charlie, and I were coming back maybe from the Rainbow. We were like walking back and it was late. I mean, it was deserted. The streets were dead. There was nobody out. And we see Sam Kinison standing in front of the Comedy Store by himself. And so we walk up to him. Hey, Sam, it's Scott and Charlie from Anthrax, you know, blah, blah, blah. Hey, guys, what's up? How you doing? Like, no, immediately just, you know, cocaine eyes.
Oh.
Like you just, you can see there was absolutely no recognition factor at all. And maybe someone once whispered
in his
ear.
Were you wearing kiss makeup?
No.
Okay.
No one ever, like, if someone had even said to him about Anthrax and they're going to sample, he had no idea at that moment. And hey, guys, what's up? How you doing? Well, you know, hey, great. Wow, it's so cool to meet you. We're massive fans, you know. And do you mind? Can we just take a picture really quick? You know, no one's going to believe that we bumped into you. And he's like, you see that convertible over there? Uh-huh. And because you see that girl in that convertible over there? Uh-huh. He goes, well, I'm gonna take that girl in that convertible. We're going to drive up the hill to my house. I'm going to fuck that girl. And then I'll come back down here and take that picture with you. So why don't you guys wait right here?
Why wouldn't...
Right? And I'm like, really? Like, and in my head, I'm like, you know, he's, wow, what a dick. But like, really? Like, we can't, it'll take literally like 30 seconds, snap. We don't even both need to be in it. I'll just take one of you and Charlie. It's cool. Like, I don't need to be in the photo. And he's like, did you hear what I just said? Like, and he repeats the whole story, not even with an attitude, but just the whole story again. And then he's like, all right, I'll see you in a little while. And he gets in the car and he drives away. And me and Charlie are just like heads hanging low, just like all bummed out. Oh, man, what a bummer. You know, he was a dick, whatever. So I started thinking about it a couple of days after that, just going, what if in his like cocaine-addled state, he thought this was like something normal and we were rock stars and we would understand. And he showed up an hour later and we were gone and we were the dicks.
Oh, man, I almost had a chance to take a picture with Anthrax.
Yeah.
And then I went and fucked that girl in the convertible.
And they didn't wait. Like, what's up, bros? You know, like, well, I can't believe it. Like, you know, and I actually started to think about that. Like, in his crazy brain at that moment, he might have been thinking that totally normal, they'll get it, and these guys will just hang out. Like, they'll just go have a drink. And, you know, meanwhile, it's like 2:30 in the morning. It's like a Monday night, and there's no one on Sunset. And, like, we're like, you know, we're not going to stand here. He's not coming back, but maybe he did.
Butterfly effect. What if you would stay there, and he came back to take the picture, and it completely changed the course of his life, and he'd still be alive today?
Oh,
you and Charlie killed him.
We killed Sam Kinison.
Oh, no. Oh, Scott, come, why did you do that?
It said he was so depressed by not taking a picture with the two guys from Anthrax, it sent him into a tailspin he never recovered from.
Never fully recovered from it.
It was our fault.
Well, anyway, that was a long time ago.
I still have a good story out of it.
It's still a great story.
I'm thinking about when I finally write my book, in between chapters of, like, the so-called serious crap of, you know, like, just Anthrax, whatever, I'm going to do, like, these kind of, like, those kind of little excerpts are going to be between the chapters, those kind of stories, and that's going absolutely nowhere.
Do you want to call the book Yes We Can Thrax, or are you not on board for that? Do you think that might not be?
Yes We Can Thrax.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
That's a good name. I actually will steal that for a chapter. Like, that'll be like the chapter when we sign our deal. It'll be Yes We Can Thrax.
Yes We Can Thrax.
And I'll lie and I'll say one of us actually said that at the, like, the night we got signed, it was like, yes, we can, Thrax. And we all put our hands in the middle and we said, yay, team.
Took a picture, and then Pearl Jam stole that for the cover of 10. And then that's the... How did you guys... I mean, I guess it really is just about doing the kind of stuff that, you want to do, but... You know, what was going on when you guys are forming and then all this glam metal like pops in the 80s? And then does that feel a little bit, does that feel like, ah, God damn it, why are these guys doing this? Or did you understand it? I mean, it's a, I mean, it seems like at the core, everyone had this, was coming from like kind of had that original space. Like you all came from the same space and then it just diverged and you guys did the heavier stuff and some guys put the hairspray on.
I mean, you know, I got to say, at the time, it was a huge bummer. Like, we hated that scene so much. Like, for no other reason than really, I mean, it was just the antithesis of what we were doing. I mean, you know, we were thrash metal. We looked the way we did, you know, whatever. We looked like the Ramones, let's say, and those guys looked like ugly ladies. And and we're playing, I guess, here, I didn't just figure it out. Sometimes it's, I have 7-month-old, you know, baby brain, so it takes me a little bit longer sometimes to get to where I'm going. But the reason why we hated it so much back then was because, and it wasn't the bands themselves that were doing it, but people were calling that music glam metal or hair metal or pop metal, and for us, it had nothing to do with metal. And none of those bands were calling themselves metal. I mean, I've become friends with guys in those bands over the years, and none of those guys ever considered themselves metal bands. They considered themselves rock and roll, hard rock, and I have no problem with that. Motley Crue is a great rock band. Poison was playing pop like music, you know? Our issue was that we were getting lumped in with these bands that were not metal. We came from, you know, this line of bands, you know, Sabbath, Priest, Maiden, you know, that kind of thing, heavy metal. That stuff, you can't even really say it came from the same line of bands as The Dolls, let's say, and Alice Cooper and Kiss, because it wasn't so much a theatrical thing. It was straight up glam pop music. Kiss wasn't a metal band. Alice Cooper wasn't metal. The Dolls certainly weren't metal. It was all rock music. So our big thing at the time was just stop calling it metal. And, of course, we have no control over the Jew-run media, even though I'm a Jew. And you think, like, where's...
Why don't you control your media better,
Scott? I know, really. Like, why don't I get invited to these meetings? But, that was our big problem with it. And, of course, we were all... in our early 20s at the time, and you know, we were idiots and we were drinking, and you know, so it just was something that, if anything, just added fuel to the fire of the music we were making. It just made us angrier. So in a way, it was actually a good thing for us.
Oh, gave you a nemesis.
Yeah, exactly. What, there's no hero without an enemy, you know, without the bad guy. And for us, they were the bad guys.
So in a way, your nemesis forces you to go farther out in the direction that ultimately is kind of what becomes your signature, because you're trying to fight that. That almost did you a favor.
No, it did. Oh no, we knew it at the time too. You know, I mean, as a comic book fan, of course, you know, but I always looked at us, we are the bad guys. Like, if anything, Anthrax is Dr. Doom. They're the Fantastic Four.
Right.
Like, you know, they're gay. We're evil. Like, that's the way I looked at it. And, like, we needed to, like, you know, we were constantly building better robots to go destroy, you know, pop glam rock or whatever you wanted to call it. And by robots, I mean writing thrash metal songs.
Sure. Was it ever hard for you? I mean, I assume especially your fans, because, listen, metal fans are very passionate nerds. Well, maybe they're not all nerds, but they're very passionate people.
Right.
And so you're in a very unique position. Was it hard for you guys at all to embrace success, because maybe people sort of felt like, no, you don't get to succeed. You're just my fucking band that I thrash in a small club with, and how fucking dare you?
That kind of started, that did start early on, because people are so passionate about, I mean, look, I'm guilty of that as well. Like, there's bands that I was into, like, when I had only a 4-track demo on cassette, and as soon as they signed their record deal, it was like, oh, I'm not into them anymore. It's like, you know, the tape was so much better. Like, I was definitely guilty of that back then. But, yeah. But my attitude was, I learned very quickly, like, the whole idea of sellout.
Whoop, sorry.
Sorry.
That was my fault.
I learned very, very early on, you know, the whole idea of sellout is, it just meant nothing to me. Unless you were going to be Fugazi and literally, you know, play your shows for $5 and, you know, and sell your records for $5 and tour in a van for the rest of your life. And that's what you're going to do and commit to it. Then, you know, the idea of even thinking about, like, yeah, we did. We signed a major label record deal, and we want to sell as many records as we can, and we want to be big, and we want everyone to hear our music. We never understood, like, our attitude was, well, how is it selling out if you want everyone to hear your music? Like, why can't thrash metal be as big as the Beatles, you know?
Right.
Like, that was our attitude. We love what we do, and everyone should love what we do because we're making good music. It's not selling out. It's just doing what you do.
No, but your core fans.
Well, of course.
They get upset because
you're not their band anymore.
Well, yeah, and they have to be okay with the fact that they're sharing you with people that they wouldn't hang out with necessarily.
Oh, absolutely.
And so it's like, wait, we're letting these fucking people into the club? Oh, I don't want them in my club.
No,
I don't want to like anything that fucking piece of shit likes.
Sure, I get it. Believe me, because we were those same people. Like, we felt that way about bands that we were into. So,
but if you don't succeed, then it's like, well, then you don't get music anymore. We have to all get jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, we weren't ever going to let that, you know, define what we were going to do. You know, we couldn't be Fugazi. It's not who we were as people, you know.
Is it harder now, you know, now that, you know, you got a family, your wife is awesome, and you got a baby, and, like, you know, is it hard to dig down to find the thrash metal place anymore? Like, what do you guys...
Hell no.
No.
I tell you what, having a baby has given me the most insanely evil, horrible thoughts. Like, because you have this life that you're now is suddenly you're responsible for this human, and you love this human more than anything I've ever loved in my lifetime. And the idea of anything ever happening to him, or, you know, any like, it's just the night terrors, the things you think about when you can't sleep at 3 o'clock at night, or you're sitting up feeding your kid in the middle of the night, and the things you like, it's just insane. The horrible, I had one the other night. Like, I'm just sitting there, and for no reason, I start thinking about my kid was trapped in the house and it's burning and my son is on fire and I can't save him.
My son is on fire.
Yeah, I mean, literally, I mean, it's just, and I've talked to a lot of other of my friends who are in metal bands who have had children, and the same thing. They said, like, this, you know, my buddy Corey from Slipknot, he's like, he had night terrors for 2 years, just unbelievable nightmares about something happening, you know, to his son. And I get it, because I have the same thing. Not like the nightmares every night, but just the idea of something ever happening to him, and where my imaginative brain goes thinking about these things. I mean, there's so much lyrical fodder and even so much more hatred for mankind now.
Because they're trying to hurt your kid.
Having a kid has made me hate humans even more than I hated humans before.
Good. No, that's a good place. You know, because in comedy, there's always, like, Patton and Posehn would always joke about, like, well, that's the death of your fucking act when you got a kid, because then you get all emotional. But obviously, it's not the case. They're still writing material. Louis C.K. found a way to make it work. I mean, it's, you know.
No, there's, if anything, it's made me more angry. It makes me hate everyone and everything even more so.
Good. I'm glad that's helped.
It has helped. It's gonna be like, Daddy, why are you so angry? Because of you, son. And I mean that in a good way.
Good. So it's not. It didn't go the other way. You're like, it's weird. Anthrax covered "Beautiful Boy" by John Lennon, which is a very weird. I don't know why they would do that.
Yeah, picture. Yeah, I shouldn't. I was gonna go somewhere with that, but. Fuck it. Yeah, John Lennon. He's the poster boy for good fathers.
He really did a great job.
Now, Pearl and I talk about this a lot. Like, you know, I get it. You know, from a talent point of view, don't get me wrong, I love John Lennon.
Yeah.
Unbelievable songwriter. You know, the Beatles. There's nothing I need to say that hasn't already been said about the talent, you know. But as people, not so much. You know, I mean, ask Julian.
Right. I always feel bad for, I mean, listen, this is knowing nothing about the family politics that went on in the Lennon household, but how it reads to me, again, as an ignorant, really uneducated person about everything, but just how it reads to me is, he had this one son, didn't really pay attention to that family. Then nope. goes and gets this, you know, like art scene wife, has a kid, writes songs for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally ignores the original. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
That poor, like, I can't even imagine what that must have been like for Julian Lennon watching that happen. Like, yeah. really? He's going to fucking record a song for that kid?
And as a father now, like, the idea of that, like if I just, like, decided, like, you know what, a couple of years from now, I just ditch my family and have a new family.
It's great that he was so supportive of Sean, but, like, maybe toss a little love in the...
there was enough to go around. He was quite a talented guy.
Yes.
I actually get
imagine.
To hang out.
Like, the guy who sang Imagine.
Yeah.
Like, really? And yeah. you're not coming
imagine
home
imagine if you gave a shit about your first kid.
Okay. Imagine if you didn't come home for Christmas.
I actually got to hang out with Sean Lennon randomly one night at a bar in New York City a few years back. And, like, just weird. Like, Pearl knew him already. And we sit down, we're having a drink, and it turns out he's a huge fan of the side project I did from the 80s called SOD,
mm-hmm.
and an even more obscure thing called the Crab Society, which was like the precursor to SOD, which was like this really crazy, like all the songs were 8 seconds long. We made this like 59-song demo. The whole demo was like 8 minutes. And total noisecore before that was even a genre. Like, mm-hmm. and... He's like, dude, I had your Crab Society demo. I'm like, well, how old were you? Four? Like, and he starts quoting these random tracks off of it. And I was like, wow, this kid, like, he knows some really, really random, obscure stuff. So then we got into this really cool conversation about metal. He's totally into metal. And then, like, I'm not thinking, like, clearly because I was a little buzzed. And I almost blurted out, like, so was your dad an Anthrax fan? And it's like, wait, his dad was killed a year
before you guys.
Anthrax was even a band, which thank God I didn't blurt that out. But then I quickly, like, made a left turn, and I said, before Anthrax came out, I changed it to Sabbath. And I said, was your dad an Sabbath fan?
Was he?
And he said, I don't know that my dad was like a Sabbath fan, but he had the records in the house and he definitely listened to Black Sabbath. Like, it's something I remember him like having the records in the house and listening to a lot heavier stuff.
Do you think it would have been weird if you were like, do you think your dad would have been an Anthrax fan? That's weird.
Yeah. Or even worse, like, your dad totally would have loved my band.
Dude. If you talk to him wherever he is, could you just let him know that Scott says hi?
But I guess the point of that story was Sean Lennon was super cool.
I can't even imagine how many fucking crazy, like, we're at a weird party with this strange collection of.
I've had a lot of those who let me in here moments like that, like just kind of like standing around like, what, you know, like, huh? Like, how did I get here? Like, and of course I can never think of them. Like, when I'm trying to think of them, like, it's random occasions I'll be like, oh yeah, God, there was that one time when, and I'll like jot it down. So I
but there must've been someone where you were kind of nerding out over them. And then you found out they were, you know, like the Sean Lennon,
Michael Moore, randomly sitting at a table with him at some independent Spirit Awards thing before it was out here in LA. I don't know if it's even the same one, but I was at something at Roseland in New York ages ago, sitting at a table with my friend Guy, and Michael Moore was at our table, and randomly it turns out like he was an Anthrax fan, and I was totally geeking out over him, and it turns out he's an Anthrax fan, so I thought that was pretty cool. But the cooler thing was the table next to us was literally like, it was De Niro, Scorsese, Pesci, Victor Argo, where if you know Scorsese movies, you know who Victor Argo is. And then the guy who plays like Billy Batts from Goodfellas, and he's on The Sopranos, that guy, Frank Vincent, that's his name. If you watch any mob movie, you know who Frank Vincent is. And all these dudes at one table next to us. So I was kind of losing my mind. And after the awards thing ended and the party starts and everyone just starts, you know, milling around and hanging out and having drinks. So I went up to Harvey Keitel. I said hi to him. He was drunk, so he was super cool. Put his arm around me and like, he was nice. Joe Pesci was super cool. I even went up to Scorsese and shook his hand. And De Niro never got up from his table, like a big round table that seats like 12 people. He never got up. He kind of sat with his head really low with a drink in front of him. Once in a while, someone that he knew would walk up and like say hi, but completely unapproachable.
I think he has social anxiety. I think he's like,
I had social anxiety because I was no way I was going to go up. Oh my, go, just say hi to him. Say hi. Like, I'm like, how can you just go say hi? Like, he was, He was literally had a force field around him.
Hi, Robert. Scott Ian from Anthrax.
Yeah,
how are
just
you?
Like, I am so not going to do anything to improve his day. Like, there's just...
He's... I mean, I think it's why he doesn't do a lot of interviews.
Right.
In the 90s, I did a thing where they would have you... They would screen a movie to a college audience.
Uh-huh.
And then they satellite piped it into a bunch of other colleges. And it would screen before the movie would open. And then I would interview people like the director or people from the movie. And I did that with Analyze This.
Right.
So it was... I interviewed Harold Ramis and Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. And he's just really like... You'd go, so what are you thinking? How is it? And he would just go, yeah. And I didn't get the sense that he was an asshole. I just got the sense of like, he is not comfortable talking to people. Like he
gotcha.
Clearly is comfortable like on a set, being a character, not being himself, not having to talk to people as himself.
Right.
So I think he's just, you know, in my whatever 20 minute experience with him was just that he is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I was
he was a huge Singled Out fan and was really nervous around me. That's probably what it was.
Definitely, maybe that's why he didn't come up to me too.
Because
he loved Anthrax.
I can't do it, De Niro. Hey, Anthrax, they're not gonna. I can't even.
Yeah,
I
he
can't
couldn't
do
believe
it.
He's like, "There's no way that guy likes my movies. I'm totally not gonna go shake his."
I mean, come on, that guy hosted Singled Out. I mean, what does Goodfellas have to offer him? I'm sure that's what De Niro was.
One time when I was a messenger. In Manhattan, like 17, 18 years old, I was working as a messenger, and Robert Duvall was standing on the corner of like 48th and 6th, and I had like literally just walked out of like Sam Ash, and I was standing on the corner going back to work, and it's Robert Duvall. It's like, oh my God. So, oh, there's Magic Johnson, by the way, for real, walking outside.
Oh, Magic Johnson is actually, I've never seen him in person.
He's tall.
He's tall. He looks good.
He looks really good. He's got the good AIDS, as they say.
I mean, he looks totally healthy. He looks great.
He looks better than he did at the peak of his career.
Tall. Tall drink of water.
But I'm following Robert Duvall. Like, literally, like, once I don't go up to anybody. Like, that's one of my things. Like, I don't want to ever bother anyone. Like, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of a geek over actors and writers and athletes and, you know, pretty much anyone, like musicians, not so much, like some musicians, like, but I've gotten to pretty much meet all my music heroes. But, you know, I just don't want to ever bother anybody. So I don't go up to anyone. And so I just start following. He was walking the same way I was walking. So I stayed about 10 feet behind him. And after about four blocks, we're standing at this corner and it's a red light. And he turns around, and he looks at me, and he says, "Can I help you?" And I was like, "Oh my god!"
Oh shit!
Like I'm that bad at following somebody. He realized, and I was like, "Good. Sorry, Mr. Duvall, I'm just a huge fan." And he's like, "What's your name, son?" And I said, "Scott." He goes, "Well, nice to meet you, Scott." And I'm like, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Duvall." And that was it. And it was like, wow, what a cool moment. Meanwhile, he's probably thinking, like, who is this weird long-haired freak with a Judas Priest jacket on, like, following me?
Maybe a handful of years later, he'd go, I met that young boy on a bicycle, and now there he is in the Anthrax band. The Anthrax musical explosion band.
And I'm all just like, oh, my God, it's Tom Hagen. What do I do?
How do you guys – I mean, obviously, it's totally passion-driven because you're doing – when did Anthrax form?
81.
So – It's not like thrash metal was huge at that point.
No.
So how do you decide? I mean, I guess it really is just passion driven that you decide to pursue a thing that you have no idea if anyone's gonna care.
Nobody cared. No, we had an idea. Nobody cared. Nobody gave a shit. Like we couldn't.
But you didn't care.
No, we couldn't even get gigs. Like where we grew up in Queens at the time. You know, we would go around to clubs and hand out demo tapes and you could not get a gig at the time, like unless you were a Van Halen cover band or, you know, or playing, you know, New Wave at the time, unless you were doing Blondie, Talking Heads. And I had no problem with any of that music. It's just that's not who we were as a band. And nobody cared about anyone playing original music, certainly original music that sounded like the music we were playing. It made it even harder for us. So, yeah, nobody gave a shit, but we didn't care. It was just like, this is the music we love to do, and this is what we're going to do, and it's either going to happen or it's not.
And the funny thing is, when you think about it, it really was, like, that type of music really was not that old at that point because, you know, that type of distort, like, electric instruments. I mean, obviously, we had electric guitars for quite a few decades, but it's not like people were doing, you know, for that long.
No, not at all. I mean, when I look back on it now, it's kind of weird because in 1981, when we were playing, I mean, all we were listening to at that moment in time really was like Maiden and Motorhead and, you know, a lot of other new wave of British heavy metal stuff. But like, you know, Maiden were basically like our gods. Maiden and Motorhead were, you know, were our gods at that point in time. And, you know, and of course, before them, I grew up listening to Zeppelin and Sabbath and Kiss and AC/DC and Ted Nugent and everything else. But
still, that's 70s, so it's no, like, it's, but, it really isn't, it hadn't been around
not.
That long.
What's crazy is in 1981, that was already old. Like, when you think about it, and when I remember this, like in 1981, stuff from 1970 was already old music. Mm-hmm. When I look back at it now to think that in 1981, we were only 11 years removed from the first Sabbath record, that's a really short amount of time.
Yeah.
But in 1981, that already seemed like that was like ages ago.
Yeah.
You know,
think about 2001.
Yeah.
That was 11 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think. And like in 1981, when we first started, that was only 4 years after I saw Kiss at the Garden.
Jesus.
In 1977 as a 13-year-old kid. Like, but in 1981, those 4 years, when you age from 13 to 17, that's, you know, that's a huge difference as a human.
Think about 4 years now. So, you're like, you can't even believe, like, what? 4 years just happened? What the fuck?
Yeah, it means nothing. Like,
but, you know, I find the older I get, and I've always been a huge Talking Heads fan, but it wasn't until a couple years ago that I really understood the song Once in a Lifetime. I always enjoyed it before, because it was, you know, I thought it was fun and quirky. Right. But just the idea of waking up one day and really having that weird existential crisis of, how did I get here? What? That's, these are my friends. This is my career. Yeah. This is my, how did this, like, it just feels like all of a sudden.
Yeah, and now, and all of a sudden, Anthrax has been around for 30 years.
It's weird.
It is fucking weird.
My dad.
There's no way that I've tried to sit around and, like, put it into some kind of context, and I can't.
Band could have been married a couple times, had a few kids.
Yeah, and it has been.
My dad always says this thing where he's, you know, my dad turned 70 in 2011, and he's like, the years turn into months. I don't know what to say. It just fucking flies by, and I'm starting to feel like the older you get, the faster the train just starts going. Jum, 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 jum,
I'm
jum,
telling
jum,
you, jum. I'll see you at some point later this year. Like, it'll be like October, November, and we're going to be like, didn't we just do Nerdist? Wasn't that like 3 weeks ago? It's going to happen. It's totally true. And
it,
I know,
hurts. It
sound
hurts.
Like a, sound like a bunch of old guys right now, but I'm telling you, kids, hold on to it while you can.
Jesus Christ, like, when you're a sophomore in high school and you're like, I still have two more years of this, it feels like, and now I think, you know, when you start setting up stuff now for work, there's usually like an 18-month turnaround where it's like, well, you know, from the time I had this idea to really get it into motion could take about 18 months.
Right.
And that's just nothing. It's no time at all.
I know. I've the next 18 months of my life, like 18 months, I pretty much know the next 10 years of my life, you know, as far as Anthrax is concerned, like, you know, on a calendar. And it seems so far away to think like 10 years from now, and it really isn't. It really isn't.
Oh, I always want to ask you, and I'm sure you told the story a million times, how did you get involved with Public Enemy? What was that?
We were, Charlie, Frankie, and I, a bass player and drummer, we grew up in Queens in the Bronx. So we were in the epicenter of hip-hop when it first started. And unlike a lot of my friends, I got into it. I don't know what it was about rap when I first heard it, when I first heard like early Run DMC, it just connected with me the same way metal did. It was the aggression. It didn't
I
have
totally
guitars,
understand that.
But the aggression of Run DMC, the aggression in their voices, in their attack, their vocal attack.
Well, it was also it was almost like a distillation of emotion, which is, I'm sure, what you guys did when you first. It's just like this is the most undistorted path between the emotions we're feeling and the music we're making.
Exactly. And I just got into it, so. You know, the three of us, we were all into it very early on. And I had a lot of friends working at Def Jam at the time. And through friends at Def Jam, I got to hear Public Enemy. Like, you know, they were playing me demos of Public Enemy. And they instantly became my favorite rap group as soon as I heard Public Enemy. And because to me, Chuck's voice was just the best voice I had ever heard in anything.
Never better than bad, because a brother is madder than mad at the
Let alone, and then what's funny is to find out years and years later that he based his voice and his rap style after Marv Albert, the sportscaster.
Oh my
and
God, that's amazing.
And when you listen to it, when you listen to some of Chuck's phrasing back then.
I totally
then,
hear it.
Yeah. It's like Marv Albert is like
Marv Albert.
Thanks, Marv Albert. Like, it's amazing. As a kid growing up in New York, I mean, he was Marv Albert was my local guy on the 6 o'clock news.
Now, was that a choice to sort of satirize an announcer to kind of like?
I don't think so. I don't.
He just liked his voice.
Yeah, I need to ask him. I just recently learned this in this BBC documentary about Public Enemy. I just learned this, so I need to ask Chuck like to get a little more in depth. But no, I think he loved Marv's voice and he loved his phrasing and his, you know, his vocal style. So it just obviously it worked. But yeah, PE became my favorite band. I ended up becoming friends with Chuck. We met at the Def Jam offices and like literally he gave me a Public Enemy shirt. I gave him an Anthrax shirt. I started wearing a Public Enemy shirt on stage with Anthrax all the time. And we were just, there was a lot of mutual respect and, you know, mutual, you know, fandom going on back and forth between the two camps. And I just had the idea to cover Bring the Noise one day when we were recording the Persistence of Time record, and it was the last thing we recorded in that session. We came up with this arrangement, like a heavy metal arrangement for that song, and then sent the tape to Chuck and said, you know, do you want to do this? And that's how it all came together.
And then did you guys tour together with Marv Albert opening for you as Fat Albert, P-H-A-T?
Marv should have, he should have like emceed the show. He should have been like the MC in between bands.
Oh, that would have been amazing. I wonder if Marv knows that.
I wonder if Marv helped
carve a path into hip hop. I think that,
yeah.
I think half the people
would. For the greatest MC of all time.
Half the people would love that, and half the people would be like, oh, really?
Yeah, because he's also the guy that, like, bit a lady on her back or something.
No. That was Frank Gifford, I think.
No, Marv Albert. Marv did too? Back in the day, yeah. Like, for some weird. Like,
so he is street.
Weird, sexy stuff.
He is street. Wow. Marv Albert. I would love to, like, say. On Marv Albert's deathbed, it's just like the layers peel back, and it's just this cool black dude underneath that was just trying to make his way. You know, like,
but I got to ask Chuck, like, you know, was it because he was like listening to Knicks games as a kid, and he just like it was something about Marv's cadence, like that. It's like I just need. To
I got
ask
almost.
Him about
I almost feel like it could have been a satirical representation of like, you know, if I'm going to preach at you, I'm going to preach at you with. The right. Satirical representation of society's voice, which is, in my head, Marv Albert, who does these games and does this like it's a presentational thing.
Yeah, I mean, they were called the Black CNN, so.
God. I so hear it now that you've said that. I've just, like.
Yeah, I only just learned this. BBC did a documentary that I got to be a part of.
And it makes sense.
And I just saw it. PE had it up on their website, so I watched it. And then I saw that. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, I can't believe I haven't known this for 30 years, you know.
That's some good trivia.
Yeah.
So what's coming up next for you? You've managed to. I mean, it's really amazing for a guy who's not really like a lead singer. Which you don't do a lot of. How many did you do a lot of vocals in the Anthrax?
I did a lot of backup yelling.
And here you go. And you, you've emerged as sort of like you do all the hosting stuff. And you know, like how did that come about? Like that usually doesn't happen. It's usually they'll grab the front man.
I could tell you exactly why. I mentioned Iron Maiden earlier. Steve Harris, the bass player of Iron Maiden. Was to me always, he was the face of that band. It's like in the 80s, Steve Harris was the guy, even though you've got one of the best frontmans in the world, Bruce Dickinson. Steve Harris, like, he was the guy, started the band. He was like, it was his vision, it was his, and not necessarily, I was certainly never the boss of Anthrax. It was never that kind of thing, but every band just has a guy that just naturally will start to, everyone starts to fill a role in a band dynamic. And I guess I just had a big fucking mouth at the time. And I saw that, hey, well, Steve Harris is the bass player and he's doing all the interviews. So even though I'm the rhythm guitar player, you know, I co-founded the band, you know, and I have a lot to say about what we're doing and I'm writing songs, obviously. I'm not the singer, but I feel like I have a lot to say and I have a point of view. And that's how it started. And then I didn't mind doing press. I didn't mind like all the interviews where some of the other guys just didn't give a shit. And when the time started and we, you know, we started making records, and then, oh, who wants to go do the European press tour? Well, what's that? It's like, well, you go to Europe for 2-3 weeks and every day you're in a different city and you sit for 9 hours a day and you answer the same questions all day long. I was like, I'll go. Like, you know, like I was into that kind of stuff, whereas other guys were like, I'm not. There's no way in a million years I would ever go do that. So I just gravitated, and that became my role. And then from that, other things just really just came out of it. I was never looking to host a show on VH1. I was never looking to be a part of those list shows. It's just people ask you, hey, do you want to do this? Well, what is it? What do I have to do? How much work does it actually involve? Do I have to study? No, I'm in, you know.
Was there anything else that you would have done other than music if thrash metal hadn't panned out? Would you have tried to pursue
other than trying to play second base for the Yankees? And as a kid who was 5'6", which, you know, I realized early on that was probably never going to happen. I always thought that if it wasn't music, I would have written comics, because it's the only other thing I knew as much about. I felt I didn't know how to write, certainly, when I was a kid, but I knew enough about comics. I felt that if I ever really put my mind to it, I was writing all the lyrics for Anthrax. I think that's probably why, too. I always felt like, well, I kind of know how to write something. Yeah. So I felt like I could have went into the comic book world. And then, of course, all these years later, strangely enough, I'm writing for DC now.
Yeah.
So I was able to open that door because people at DC were fans of mine. And my point, they were like, I sat in this meeting at DC years ago, and they said, we really think you have a point of view and you have something to say, and we'd like, you know, if you want to give it a shot. And I kept turning around, like literally, like to see if someone else was standing behind me, because I just couldn't believe that.
Oh, no, not you, Scott. Yeah. We just liked you, so we had you in the room.
Grant Morrison is standing behind
Grant,
you.
Grant, do you want to do this comic?
Yeah. We just, you know, we're just Anthrax fans. Will you sign this copy of your new record?
Will you play while Grant writes?
But yeah, you know, so it's kind of like it opened the door for that. And now I'm actually proactively... I'm so happy about that part of my life that I'm obviously proactively trying to do as much as I can in that world now and look for other gigs. And my goal would be to get a regular gig. Like if DC called or anyone called and said, hey, do you want to do a year on, you know, Animal Man? I'd be like, yes.
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
I mean, they didn't say that. I'm saying, of course I would.
I got to pick Animal Man back up. I read the first two issues of it.
Oh, my God, dude. The new Jeff Lemire, however you pronounce his name, it's amazing.
Yeah, I want to I did the first two issues of it, and I really liked it. And then I just got busy, and like 2-3 months have gone by.
I'm 2 issues behind as well. Like, and I only mention Animal Man because that and like Swamp Thing, the reboots of those two have just been, I feel like really, really great.
Yeah, they did a really good job with those.
Keep kicking this thing under
the
table.
All right.
Anyway.
Let's fucking tear this place up.
Comics is something, outside of music, even right now, it's something that I'm really, really stoked about. And actually this week, other than like doing this right now today and like two other like interviews I have to do for the upcoming Anthrax tour, all this week I'm working on the Demon right now for DC, and like that's all I'm doing this week because I'm like 2 months behind deadline.
When's the tour?
We start again January 22nd in the States.
Oh, shit. That's,
yeah. When is this going to air? When is this going to be on?
Well, I'll put it up before that.
Yeah, January 22nd, second leg of a U.S. tour. We did the first leg. Our record came out in September, Worship Music. We started touring the States right after that with Testament and Death Angel opening. The tour was fucking unbelievable.
Okay, so like, Worship, Testament, Death Angel, so it's a Christian...
It's very, 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 very Christian, very proper.
Yep.
Come out and worship with us. You'll have a lot of fun.
God is both God and Manthrax.
Hey, that, you know, I always said the best, you know... I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway,
you have that thing. Listen, and when you first showed up, you were like, "It's my first day back at work, and I have a kid, and my brain feels like sludge."
Yeah, exactly. But seriously, the tour's been great. Like, sold out. Doing. It's one of those things where I hate to belittle it in any way, but sometimes I feel like, you know, you hang around long enough, and everything comes full circle. And it's crazy because we released this record. It was our first studio record in 8 years, and. We're doing better business now than we have since the late 80s. Like, we entered number 12 on the Billboard charts beyond everyone's expectations. The tour was sold out. Like, everything's going great with these dates coming up. We're booked all year. We're playing bigger and better shows than we have in forever. Like, it's crazy how everything's just like there's this whole new generation of kids who didn't get to see us that first time around and are just way into it again.
I mean, there really is something to just sticking it out.
We're a working band. We've just been on tour all these years, playing gigs. I mean, it's the thing that's enabled us to stay here all these years is the fact that we love playing live and we're really good at it. And we were able to go 8 years without releasing a record and just basically go out and gig for 8 years and play festivals in Europe and do our thing. And we made a record that's fucking great. And people are really digging it.
Well, at Scott Ian on Twitter.
Yes.
And
Scott_Ian.
Scott_Ian. Yeah. @Scott_Ian. And
there's also @Anthrax on Twitter.
And @Anthrax. Anything else you want to promote while you're here?
While I'm here right now, my wife Pearl has a new record out called The Swing House Sessions. It's an acoustic, basically acoustic version of her record that she released. And
when are you guys gonna mash up some music together?
Well, I wrote on her stuff because her stuff is rock. I mean, she's straight up rock, and that's where I come from. I mean, I come from AC/DC, Ted Nugent, Cheap Trick, Kiss, Aerosmith. You know, that's really what I first got into when I started listening to music and really got serious about guitar. So it was kind of right in my wheelhouse to play rhythm guitar in her band. I wrote a little bit on the record, but the guy, Jim Wilson, that she writes with is a much better writer for that kind of stuff. I'm more of a metal riff guy than a rock riff guy, but I could certainly play the shit out of it. So it's fun when I get to play shows with her.
Was her dad an Anthrax fan?
I can't say Meatloaf was an Anthrax fan. No, he had heard of us and stuff, but no, he wasn't listening to
Honey, thrash metal! Come on!
But you can check out hers at Pearl Aday, PEARLADAY. You can check her out.
So sweet. Your wife is so sweet. It was always really nice to see you guys, like, you know, Monday after Monday, turn up to that Monday Night Largo show. And
we like to laugh.
That's good.
Our relationship, you know, it's funny, back in the day, too, like 2000 when we first started dating, 2000, 2001, we were both coming out of terrible relationships. And we were both drinking like unbelievable amounts of booze, like tolerance that now, if I even think about it, I have to go to the emergency.
Oh yeah, room. I was too. I was right there with you.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, like everyone was in the same boat back then, and like it's amazing that we made it through those first few years with the amount we were drinking. But like Largo was like our regular thing. Like go get unbelievably like go to Largo and then go to the Coronet on La Cienega, where the new Largo is now, strangely enough. That was like our crawl, like 3-4 nights a week. Like,
well, and Largo used to have that bar a couple doors down from it on Fairfax,
which was Max's back in the day.
Yeah,
now it's
right.
Called the Dime.
The Dime, yeah. And it was the size of a bachelor apartment.
Yeah.
And you would just fucking crawl from Largo to there and then go the opposite direction to Damiano's Pizza that was open until 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
or the Cantor's across the street.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Basically that street was designed to keep you drunk and fat.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like when I think about how much I drank back then and, there's no way now, like, forget it. It's like, you know, I have like 3 beers. It's like, thank you. Good night.
Oh, I can't even have like, if I can't even drink coffee. I'm like, is there caffeine in this? Cause I just don't know if I'm going to be able to, I have a lot of stuff to do today. I just don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. Maybe.
I just to make sure it's not a baby emergency when I see my
Oh, you're good. Everything's okay.
Yeah. Everything's okay.
Oh, Scott, you're going to be fine. You're just good dad. Hey, Nick. Nick's been over there this whole time.
Hey guys,
do you want to give us the last line of the show, or do you want to add anything?
Whoa!
Oh, Nick, I give you one line, and look what you do.
Nick just blew his ears out.
Microphone. Yeah, blew my ears out. Enjoy your burrito.
Okay, good. Good read. Good read. Good to see you again, Nick. Happy New Year.
You too.
All right, Scott Ian, thank you for being here. Good to see you, man. Also, want to thank Magic Johnson for dropping by. If by dropping by is equated to breezing by in the background and not stopping to acknowledge us in any way. And yeah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that's simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to hover.com/Nerdist.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.